Warning, this episode contains spoilers, strong language, discussion of Katharine Hepburn's lady bits, and pink champagne.
If it's something that's really well done the first time, it's not broken, stop trying to smash it.
I'm always intrigued to see what it is that people are going to do with something that's already been done before.
I hate remakes.
I love remakes. Welcome, everybody, to the fourth episode of I Hate / Love Remakes. I am Noel, and joining me, as always, is Evie.
I am drunk on pink champagne.
I have yet to drink alcohol. Is there a difference between pink champagne and the regular? Is it like strawberry, or...?
No, I think it just has a different color. I've had champagne that was pink before, and I'm like, it's a different color. That's all I got from it.
All right.
And when you drink it, you fall on your ass in about 10 seconds flat.
That's kind of why I don't drink.
Yeah, not blaming you there. It's really not that much fun.
All right, so before we get into the main discussion, I am going to be at the Chicago Comics and Entertainment Expo, also known as C2E2. I'll be co-hosting the Made of Fail video logs that are going to be filmed there, and we don't have a panel or a booth or anything set up, but we will be on the floor, so if anyone sees my name on a tag, come up and say hi. I'd be happy to meet you.
Are you going to be wearing anything special that people can recognize you by, Noel?
Why, yes, I will. I have t-shirts made for both Made of Fail and IHateLoveRemakes.com. So if you see someone wearing a shirt that says I hate remakes or I love remakes, it's probably me, because it says one on either side.
That's the greatest shirt ever.
So if you see me there on the floor, by all means, come up, say hi. I'd love to discuss remakes with you. I still support them.
Do not punch him, please.
Okay. Do you want to tell us what it is we're going to be discussing today?
We're going to be discussing the original Love Affair, which is from 1939, and then it was remade as An Affair to Remember in 1957, and then remade again as Love Affair in 1994.
And this is interesting because I have never seen any of these movies before we sat down for this podcast.
For reals?
Right. I had never seen them before. I think I had heard of them. I mean, there were bits where I'm watching it and I'm like, oh, I remember hearing about this a long time ago, but I have never seen it.
Well, you know what? I'm the girl, so clearly I would have at least seen An Affair to Remember.
Right, and forcing me to watch three romance movies is your revenge for me making you watch the Psycho and Godzilla remakes.
Actually, I pointed out that I did like part of Psycho.
But then you masturbated.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about that, Noel.
Okay, but I did make you watch the Godzilla remake.
Yeah, but I pretty much mind-wiped that from my brain, so it's okay. It's okay.
You purged it.
Pretty much, yeah.
The last episode was a cleansing experience.
Exactly. I just have our podcast to remember it by, because I'm like, it was like a rage blackout, and I don't remember it.
Right. And speaking of the Godzilla, we wanted to point out that we tried some new things with the format last episode, and it ended up giving us 6 hours of audio and over 3 hours of published podcast, and we're not doing that again.
No, because Noel does not want to edit for that long, and I don't blame him.
If you guys want us to do our episodes longer and more in-depth and detailed and maybe even break them up like we did with Godzilla, tell us and we'll try to find a way to make it work. But that's a lot of editing. So we're kind of pulling back to our earlier format of just kind of more looser roundtable discussion instead of hitting the story beat point by beat point by beat point. You guys let us know. Do you want us to stick with this format or do you want to challenge us a little and make us go for the more detailed stuff? Because if enough people tell us to, we probably will because we're total whores for an audience.
Also, if you send us cash bribes.
Yes, cash bribes are always welcome. Nah, we'll save that so you guys can save your money. But just if there's an audience out there, I know we have at least a few regular listeners. You guys let us know. Do you want us to do something more in depth like Godzilla or something looser like we do here or with Psycho or Parent Trap? Get back to us on that. Our comment section is always open. By all means, let us know. And also, let us know what you think of the films we're discussing.
Yeah, if you hate them, you should probably tell us.
Yes. And I know pretty much none of our male viewers are going to be tuning in for this episode, but...
Come on! Okay, seriously, the 1957 version? If guys want to know how to get girls, just do stuff in that movie. Just pick lines from that movie, use that, go.
Yes.
It's gold, people, it's gold.
Okay. Let's start with the 1939 film Love Affair. The film was directed by Leo McCarey, written by Leo McCarey, Mildred Cram, Delmer Daves, and Donald Ogden Stewart, and stars Charles Boyer and Irene Dunne. Michel Marnay is a French painter and playboy heading to America to marry the socialite Lois Clark. Terry McCary is a lounge singer in a relationship with her boss Kenneth Bradley and is returning home from a European shopping trip. By chance, the two happen to meet aboard a cruise ship crossing the Atlantic. The two are attracted to one another but try to keep their relationship at the level of just friends, until a number of situations, including a layaway trip to visit Michelle's grandmother, lead them to their first kiss. The ship arrives in New York and the two, confused about their feelings but unwilling to create a scandal, part with their separate fiancés after agreeing to meet again in 6 months atop the Empire State Building should they still want to be together. As the months go by, they break up with their significant others and look forward to their reunion. On that day, Terry is hit by a car because she kept looking up at the Empire State Building, where Michelle waits and waits before finally leaving alone. The accident has left Terry paralyzed, and she doesn't want Michelle to know until she finds out if she'll ever walk again, an answer that may never come. No longer tied to the lives of luxury of their fiancés, Michelle has been working as a billboard painter while trying to sell original pieces in his free time, and Terry takes a job as a choir teacher at an orphanage. The two take another try at relationships with their former fiancés, but their paths awkwardly and briefly intersect at a concert. On Christmas Eve, Michelle finally visits Terry and toyingly vents about how she left him hanging. She still won't tell him about her injury, but when he relates the story of a handicapped woman who bought one of his paintings, he figures out the truth when he sees the piece hanging in her bedroom. The two come together, reunited at last. Evie, do you recommend this movie?
I really wanted to like this movie, and... it's adequate. You know, if someone really likes romance or if they just really like old school movies, I'd say sure. But this movie is just, it's so adequate. Like, not a slight against Irene Dunne, but I don't know what she's doing in this movie. She doesn't have that kind of chemistry with Charles Boyer. And I've seen her in other stuff. So it's not like she's not a good actress. It's just this particular movie, she doesn't really work for me. And just, I think the bulk of the movie really depends on the chemistry between the two stars, which I'm not really getting here.
However, I do recommend this film. I think it's a genuine classic. What seems like a simple story on the surface is actually a sweeping and intricate character study about two people who are willing to completely alter their lives just to ultimately be together, and the realities, complications, and disappointments that come along the way. The cast is strong, and I found the chemistry between Dunne and Boyer to be very genuine. The dialogue has a snappy naturalism to it, even to modern ears. The filmmaking itself is quiet and contained in a way that heightens the intimacy. The dramatic plot twists hit me like a sack of bricks the first time I watched it and still packed a surprising punch the second time around. I was so absolutely engrossed in these people and their journey. I think it's a perfect film, an absolutely perfect film. Let's move on to the 1957 film An Affair to Remember. The film was again directed by Leo McCarey, written by Leo McCarey and Alfred Hayes, and stars Cary Grant and Deborah Carr. We'll skip a synopsis since the script for this one is over 90% identical to its predecessor. Other than some added scenes and changed dialogue, the only major difference is that Michel Marnay's name has been changed to Nicky Ferrante. Evie, do you recommend this film?
Yes. Oh, did you know that actually the whole thing in New York? It was originally supposed to be San Francisco.
Are we talking about for the original film as well? Because that was New York.
No, it was for when he's doing the...
Oh, so he was going to change the setting.
Yeah.
I wonder if they were going to do like the Golden Gate Bridge instead of the Empire State Building.
I have no idea. All I know is that Cary Grant nixed it. Hmm. And he was just like, no, I don't like it, so...
Okay. I wonder if they were going to make him an Australian.
Oh, God, no.
Well, where else would he be crossing through the Pacific from?
I don't know.
Okay, well, anyways, let's get back. And do you recommend An Affair to Remember, Evie?
Yes, I do.
Okay, tell us why.
I love it. I love this whole movie. I love it. Is that a good enough reason?
Give a little more in depth. What is it about it that you love so much?
I think, well, the one thing that it has going for it probably that the original doesn't is that it is filmed in color and you get, at the very least, you get Deborah Carr's beautiful red hair. And the look of it, the chemistry between Cary Grant and Deborah Carr, who actually were in Dream Wife together in 1953. So this wasn't the first time that they were in a movie together. And they have this chemistry, the back and forth between them. This could be one of those movies where the plot could make no sense, but the back and forth between them is so good that I would watch it just for that. And the supporting cast, I feel like in this movie, you actually get to know the supporting characters a little bit more, like the two fiancés, as opposed to in the original, I don't think you really did.
Anything else?
I love Cary Grant. He's so sexy.
Kind of goes without saying.
There we go. After I watched this movie for the first time, I spent about 3 months wanting to be Deborah Carr. So, yeah, I love this movie. I cannot recommend it enough. And I'm not someone who really likes romantic movies that much, but I love this movie. I love it.
I also recommend this movie. This is about as good as a remake can get in that it keeps everything that made the original so great and tosses in a few new little bits of its own. The new leads have just as great of a chemistry, the dialogue is still flowing and real, it still refuses to pull any punches in the honesty of the relationship, with all the twists hitting with as much weight as they did the last time around. The look and feel of the film is more open and vibrant thanks to widescreen and Technicolor, but it still never loses the intimacy of the central romance. If I had to nitpick, the only thing keeping this film from being perfect is that they took the annoying group of singing children from the first film and made them even more annoying.
Yeah, they have really, like, long, long singing scenes in it. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
We'll get to the kids. So let's move on to the 1994 film Love Affair. This film was directed by Glenn Gordon Caron, written by Robert Towne and Warren Beatty, and stars Warren Beatty and Annette Bening.
And Warren Beatty also worked as a producer on the film, so you can guess how that's going to go.
Other than the fact that some of the best films made in the last 30 years had him as writer, producer, director, actor, so...
Name five.
Reds, Bonnie and Clyde.
Bonnie and Clyde I'll give you, but Reds is really long.
It's long, but it's well made.
Eh.
All right, so let's move on to the film here, though.
Okay.
So. In this version, Terry McKay is still a singer, but the male lead is now Mike Gambrill, an ex-football star working as a sports announcer who's the center of tabloid gossip because of his engagement to a wealthy socialite. The two first meet aboard a flight to Australia, but when a fierce storm and a blown engine forces the plane to land in the Pacific, they suddenly have a lot more time to spend together when the passengers are picked up by a Russian cruise ship headed for Hawaii. From here, the story covers all the same beats. They spend their first night together after meeting Mike's elderly aunt. The two again part ways when the ship finally reaches America, and their reunion atop the Empire State Building is again foiled by Terry's accident and paralysis.
She needs to learn how to look in traffic. Jesus.
She becomes a music teacher at a school, and Mike settles at a college where he coaches the football team. The final scene is identical, with Mike confronting her, Terry unwilling to tell him the truth, but him figuring it all out when he finds a painting he did of her on her bedroom wall. Evie, do you recommend this movie?
No. It hurts me to my very core, but no.
Why? You have to explain.
No, I don't.
Yes, you do.
I know. This movie is just like, it seems to think that it needs to ramp up all this stuff, like, they're on a flight and then they have to land and then they're on this cruise ship. And I'm just like, what a completely random happenstance. And of course, there's no phones on the cruise ship. And seriously, movie, they had phones in An Affair to Remember. And if I'm watching a movie with Katharine Hepburn and I don't have one note about her in my notes, that's got to be something wrong. And oh my God, the music, fuck off music. Seriously, that music was so not appropriate. I thought it was beautifully shot. But the biggest problem is that Warren Beatty and Annette Bening seem very comfortable with each other, like people who have been married for a while, which when they're supposed to be playing people who have just met, that's not really working for me. And the whole relationship, they don't have that kind of chemistry of people who are just meeting for the first time. And also, they kind of look like my parents, so there you go. Yeah, no, seriously. I was watching this movie and halfway through, I figured out why, and I'm just like, This movie is like watching my parents make out. No, I can't in good conscience recommend this to anybody.
I, however, do recommend it.
I'm going to go be really shocked about this.
It's not as smooth and polished as the earlier two, and I don't understand the overly complicated introduction with the plane and the crashing in the Pacific and landing on the atoll and all that. But once you get 20 minutes in, it becomes a very gentle and faithful adaptation that stays true to the story while still finding ways to modernize it and give the leads their own identity. Benning feels a little awkward half the time, but I thought Beatty was good and the broad supporting cast of familiar faces is excellent. There's some awkward transitions and a little too much focus lighting on the eyes, but the director otherwise handles the romance well and lets his actors carry the drama without getting too gimmicky. It's not as solid a film as the first two, but still a good and enjoyable effort in its own right. And so let's open up the conversation now.
To all three, or to the first one, or what?
To any of them. Where do you want to start? Do you want to start on the first, on why you don't like the first one, or why you don't like the third one?
Let's just start with the first one and work our way over.
Okay. I'm surprised you didn't really like the first one.
I think a lot of it is, I honestly think I'm tainted by the fact that I did see An Affair to Remember first.
Okay.
And that one to me is the best out of the three. And it's really, out of the three of them, you really can't match the chemistry of Cary Grant and Deborah Carr. Like, none of the other movies come close in that kind of chemistry.
I'll agree with you on the third one, but what I liked about the first one is, and again, this is probably because I watched them in order, is I am not as familiar with Charles Boyer and Irene Dunne as I am with Cary Grant and Deborah Carr, so I was able to approach them more as, you know, the characters than as, you know, the glamorous stars of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they felt more real to me, a little more grounded, a little more natural. And I actually like that, you know, it starts off with him hitting on her and her rebuffing him. And actually their friendship builds because every time he has a line to throw at her, she has one to throw right back. And so they kind of build this great rapport. And you have the sense that even if these two didn't hook up, they would probably stay friends and they would probably stay really close. And I like then that they don't want to cross that line, but they eventually get to the point where they can't help but cross that line. And even when they cross it, they're like, we went too far, we got to pull back. And that's something that you kind of get in all three films. But I like the original film because it just felt more subtle to me. Affair to Remember isn't, I'm not dissing that. It's just, It's much more bigger and glamorous and Hollywood-y. Whereas the original film, it feels more like that's how it would be in real life.
Yeah.
Just to me.
Oh, no, I'd agree with you that would be how it might be in real life. But problem being that I was watching a romantic movie.
Yes, and I thought it was even more romantic because it felt more honest and more real.
I don't know. I've had some really great conversations with people that I've never seen again. So sometimes on boats.
Well, yeah, but you're on a cruise ship and you're kind of stuck bumping into each other. That's actually part of the setup that I loved is that, you know, yeah, these people could cross paths and then never see each other again, but they're kind of stuck in a location where they're going to keep bumping into each other. And it's the fact that they keep bumping into each other that it kind of forces itself on them, the relationship.
I think I maybe like the back and forth of the, I'm just going to keep referencing An Affair to Remember, and you're like, shut up, Evie.
Well, I agree with you. That is the best of them in terms of the two. You can't go wrong with Cary Grant and Irene Dunne.
Yeah, well,
except for Quo Vadis, where she was terrible, but everyone was terrible in
it's
that.
It's Deborah Carr and Cary Grant, not Irene Dunne and Cary Grant.
Sorry, Cary Grant and Deborah Carr.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You know what? I think it's just the way that they play off of each other, because Charles Boyer and Irene Dunne, both really good actors, and I've seen them in their stuff, but romantically, they don't play off each other that well.
I think it builds over the course of the movie, but I agree it starts off awkward,
yeah.
But it feels real.
And the way that they first get them together is with her reading the telegram or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it kind of flies out of his hand and she picks it up and is reading it.
Well, as opposed to she just randomly happens to have his cigarette case that he couldn't find 10 seconds before. I don't think it's any more awkward of a setup.
It's a little bit more believable with the cigarette case.
I think both of them are more believable than the plane suddenly going down in the Pacific.
Oh, God, yes. It's magic.
I don't know. I liked it. I think Deborah Carr had more confidence and swagger to her.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Irene Dunne was a little more reserved. She still had the charming glint in her eye, but what I like is that these are two people who almost think that they shouldn't be together, because they would have to change everything in their life in order to be together, and in fact they do end up changing their entire lives, only to have it blow up in their face before they eventually settle it down again. And they can see that, you know, this is something that if we're going to do this, it is going to change everything that we are, and there's an uncertainty there. Of do they want to go that far? Are they willing to do that? And I like that because it felt real. You kind of get that in the 57 one, but it's a little more confident.
Well, yeah, because it's Cary Grant.
I thought the uncertainty of the 1930s version, I think, better sold her unwillingness to tell him about her injury. Whereas in both The Affair to Remember and the 90s version, I'm kind of like, you're kind of leaving the guy hanging.
Well, in the 57 version, that's the characters that Deborah Carr would play a lot, is the stiff upper lip darling kind of women. That was kind of a staple of how women were supposed to be, is, oh no, I'm fine. And whereas now women would be like, yeah, I'm in a wheelchair, guess what, you get to deal with it. Which is why actually the 94 one doesn't really make sense to me, because I'm just like, well, why wouldn't she tell him?
Yeah, by that point in time, yeah.
The 57 one, I would still give it, because that was kind of a staple of how women were supposed to be.
Yeah. But you know what I liked is that this story doesn't really follow staples. I mean, this story doesn't really ever go quite where you would expect it to go. It doesn't feel like, you know, your typical Hollywood romance. There's a little more inventiveness and a little more complication to it.
Well, that's true. But there's still going to be stuff that's sort of like almost a trope, I guess, or something.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. I just thought it was better sold than the original. One of the other things I like about this movie is that it almost... So many movies would, you know, have the relationship on the ship, and then they decide to part ways after the ship, and that would be the end of the movie. Or if you keep going and then have it be where they reunite at the Empire State Building, but she gets injured right before that happens, or gets hit by a car right before that happens, that would be the end of the movie. This film kind of takes where most movies would end and then keeps going further, and then going further. I love that because, you know, most romantic comedies, romantic dramas, they only cover like a week or two of in a person's life or even a day or two. And this one covers like an entire year in these people's lives and how their entire lives are affected by this relationship. I like that. And that goes to all three of them, so.
But this also did go to the fact that when they would have romantic movies back then, they didn't really end on a sad note. Whereas nowadays, you can have a romantic movie and the two leads don't end up together or something like that.
Right.
But back then, that really did not happen.
And what I love about this one is that it ends with them reunited, but there's still that bittersweetness to it, of everything they've lost to get there. You know,
yeah, because she still can't walk.
But then for some reason in the 94 version, it's like he's suddenly successful again.
Yeah, what the...
Yeah, I mean, what I like about the 30s and the 50s version is they are both pretty, I don't want to say poor, but they've gone from the upper lives of luxury and fur coats to just having to scrape a living and living in small apartments and whatnot.
Well, actually, we don't know in the original where Nick is living, because he's a painter.
He's still working in New York, because remember he's painting the billboards?
Well,
he's Michelle in the original.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. Yes. Well, Michelle in the original, he's painting the billboards. That's before the car accident, though.
No, that's not. That's after.
No, it is before, because that's when the guy comes.
No,
it is.
Oh, wait. No, yeah, that's right. Because when he broke up with the socialite, the rich fiance,
yeah,
he's suddenly left poor and he starts doing that. And then, yeah, and then he takes the trip to Europe, finds out his grandmother died and then came back, tried to hook up with his fiance again. And when he couldn't go through with that and he saw Terry at the theater, he decides, I'm going back to Europe and I'm going to confront her one last time. But yeah, well, that's because he was starting to sell his paintings by then.
Yeah, but he was painting the billboards and then his manager, I guess, or whatever, comes around and is just like, I sold your painting. And then the guy was like, yay me.
And of course, that's the painting in the end.
No, actually, that's not the painting in the end, because that one's given away.
You're right.
Yep.
I just watched this again.
You're so pretty, Noel. It's okay. It's okay. You know what? This is the movie that I've watched more times than anything, so.
I've only seen it twice, so yeah. Okay, so yeah, no, you're right about the structure, yeah. But what I like is that it's honest about the fact that by breaking up with their respective fiancés, who they both could have lived a very probably happy and comfortable life with, they are now having to go out and scrape along a living of their own.
Yeah, you do kind of get that. I mean, I don't know where Nick is, but again, artists back in 39 would not have, like a painter in 39, you're not going to be making that kind of money.
Right.
Is it just me, or does the a buying trip that she says sound like hiking the Appalachian Trail?
Yeah, she doesn't exactly look like someone who's going to be hiking the Appalachian. Oh, I see what you mean.
No, I mean, like, she, you know, she says that he sends her on a buying trip, and I'm like, yes.
She's a lounge singer, and he's a manager, so he sends her to Europe to buy things.
No, it just makes it seem like he's sending her away so he can go have an affair.
Yeah. But you know what I liked is I liked her fiance in all three of them because he was a good guy. He stood by her even when she said, I'm leaving to get married and she gets injured. He's there for her. He's there helping her out in all three versions.
Yeah. And you know what? I feel almost like the second one in A Fair to Remember. That's the one where we got to get to know him the most, because with the first one, the first time we meet him, that's when she comes into the store, I think, isn't it? Or no? No.
We meet him on the docks. Yeah. But then we don't see him again until, you know, she's already broken up with him. And he's like, hey, I see her at the store. I'm going to try to win her back. But then she's like, I'm getting married.
Yeah. And I feel it does a disservice to the supporting characters because a lot of them are almost afterthoughts in the original.
Well, what I liked is that he seemed like an afterthought. But then when he actually served importance in all three versions, he's there.
Yeah. And you didn't think that maybe that just.
It took a throwaway character and then suddenly revealed that, oh, he's not quite so throwaway. And here we'll let you get to know him a little better.
Yeah, but the only thing that you know him from is the fact that he takes care of her. You don't know him from anything else.
But you don't need to know anything else. All you need to know is that, you know, this is a man who still cares for her. And he'll even be there for her, even if she's not returning that affection.
You know what? I prefer in An Affair to Remember where I actually did get to know him, because I do feel like I need to know him a little better, because if he's just the doormat that takes care of her and nope, she doesn't love him, it just makes him feel kind of doormatty and it kind of makes me not like the lead character.
Well, no, but here's the thing is she never accepts his money. He doesn't pay for any of her hospital stuff. That's why she still has to go and get a cheap apartment and work at a school or an orphanage. This is in all three of them. He doesn't pay her bills. He's just there for her as a friend. She doesn't accept his money in any of them.
Yeah, I know, but it's...
They try to hook up again when they go to the concert, but then, of course, she sees Nikki / Michelle / Mike.
See, I didn't even get it that they were trying to hook up. I get it that he was just taking a friend out.
Well, I got the sense that they were trying to rebuild what they had lost just to see if they could, and then they saw what it was that they had lost it all over again, and then he shows up at her apartment that night.
Yeah, I didn't get that at all.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, well...
Like, at all?
I didn't get the sense that they were all trying to hook up again, but I got the sense that they were at least trying to just go out with each other again just to see where they stand.
Yeah, you know what? I could be wrong. Yeah. I could be the idiot who's missing all this.
Yes, I have the fresh perspective.
Exactly. You're kind of the noob to this. I've seen it too many times to be able to be impartial, kind of.
What I do have a problem, though, is all three films kind of skip out on the lead guy's fiance.
Yeah.
The rich socialite woman. I mean, Kate Capshaw in the remake has a few extra scenes, but you still don't really get to know her any better.
Yeah, I think with Kate Capshaw, we have her in... God, what is it? Like,
I mean, like, yeah, that scene where they meet in the restaurant again.
Yeah, I think she's not in it for very long, which I'm like, dude, it's...
And you think about the other ones, you only see her in, like, three scenes, you know?
Yeah.
You really don't get a sense of who she is other than she's a wealthy socialite who's marrying a famous playboy.
Yeah. The 94 love affair. Mm-hmm. It has Pierce Brosnan as the fiance, and he's so underused in that.
Well, he is, but that's only as much as that character needs to be used because it's not his story. It's not the story of their relationship.
I disagree.
They are only there in support of the main romance.
See, but I wanted to know more about him.
By the novelization.
Why? Shouldn't I just get it from the movie?
No, because it's not his story. It is the story of these two people, and everything else is peripheral in their lives in terms of how it affects or is affected by this central romance.
Yeah, but in the 57 version, you do get a little bit more of him.
I didn't see that there was really any more or less of him in that version.
You at least get a little bit more in that scene when they're watching Nikki on TV.
Wait, they had that in this one too when she saw him on TV in the 94 version.
They did, but it's more like he's on the phone and then it's just like, I'm not unpacking. It's a really almost a throwaway scene. You don't really get to know him. You just know he's on the phone.
I agree with you that, yes, he is still kind of kept underdeveloped in all versions, including the 57 one. But I disagree with you in that I don't think he needed to be. I like that you only have a hint of his character and who he is. And I like that this film has a lot of things that it suggests instead of actually developing because it knows where its focus is.
Mm.
This story knows what it's focused on. And everything else is peripheral to that focus, as it would be with their lives. Is, you know, everything in their lives suddenly becomes peripheral to this relationship that even when it breaks up, they're still filled with thinking about each other. And that's where it gets tougher in the second half when they try to push themselves past thinking about each other and they fail at it when they run into each other again.
I don't know. I don't think I see it. But you know what? I've never had a relationship like that either, so it could be that I'm just not getting it because I've never had that.
Same here. And, you know, I get the sense that they could have moved on if they hadn't run into each other again. If it wasn't for the fact that they just bumped into each other again at the concert, I think they could have eventually gotten over each other and gone on to live happy. I don't know that he would have hooked up with the socialite, but he probably would have, you know, gone back and become a painter and maybe met someone else. And I think that her and her former fiancé actually probably would have gotten back together again.
Well, I don't know, because her intention seems to be to get better so that she can go to Michelle/Nick/Mike.
Right, but you know, as time goes by, you get the sense that she's starting to let go of that. I mean, you have the sense that, you know, she knows at some point he's not going to wait forever.
I think maybe in the 94 version you get that, but in the first two versions, I really didn't.
Well, you know, what I actually liked is that at the concert, you have the thing where they see each other together and he wants to say goodbye. And it's like, that is almost her wake-up call of, look, he's moving on.
Mm-hmm.
Because she doesn't have the full context or everything. And he has a sense that she's moved on too, and that makes him angry, and that's why he goes to confront her. And that's why he's kind of being a dick, talking about how he stood her up when in reality he's accusing her of standing him up. And I like that he actually goes there to pretty much chew her out, but he still can't quite bring himself to really just tear her apart because he's still in love with her. But he went there to say goodbye and to burn the bridge, and yet they end up coming together.
Yeah, but only because he figures out that the painting is the one. She's the girl.
Yeah, I mean, talk about Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah, it's the magical painting.
But I love how that painting just sneaks up on you. You kind of get the sense of these paintings and all stuff. And in the original film and the 94 version, you actually see that painting and you actually hear about him giving it away.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not until he actually reveals that, and he said that the woman was, and he's going to say handicapped.
Or in a wheelchair.
Right, or in a wheelchair. And that's when, like, the light bulb goes off in his head and he realizes she hasn't gotten up from that couch in this entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And so he starts looking around the apartment and there he finds the painting, realizes what happened to her. It's something that shouldn't work, but by God, it did. I was all teary-eyed during all three versions whenever that scene happened.
It's because, well, A, because you're a girl, Noel.
Yes.
I'm clearly the manliest one on this podcast.
My boobs are bigger than yours.
I don't doubt that. I think it's because this, well, at least for the 57 version, I was emotionally invested enough with the characters that you do kind of, it's like, if you weren't invested with the characters, you'd be like, that is the stupidest plot point ever.
I was invested in the original one, too, so.
Mm-hmm.
And the 90s one took me a while to grow to the characters, because I don't know why Annette Bening just kind of felt awkward in this movie. I mean, you know, Warren Beatty was all confidence and cocky charm and all that stuff, but
really?
I just found Annette Bening to be kind of awkward in the film.
Really?
At least for parts of it.
See, for me, it would have been Warren Beatty that seemed like the awkward one, because when he's first trying to talk to her, and I'm like, this is your idea of smooth talk? Seriously?
Well, you know, I mean, that's the thing is, in the original film, in the 50s version, you can feel the attachment between them. At least for me in the original. The attachment between them is kind of immediate. In the 90s version, it's like he keeps hitting on her and she just wants him to shut up and go away. And it's like she's kind of skeeved out by him for a while. And it's not until like halfway through the cruise ship that she kind of starts to warm to him. And then when they go to visit his aunt.
I don't really blame her because he's supposed to be like this ladies' man, Lothario.
Right.
I'm watching this movie and going, why? Because I don't get it. Like the way that he hits on her on the airplane, I'm like, this is so awkward. Oh, dear God.
I know. He's just kind of blatantly doing it. It's almost like a Tourette's reaction to him. If he's got to hit on any woman he sees because it's a scandal.
See, I didn't even see that. To me, he was just a babbling babbler who babbles.
Right. You know, the first 20 minutes of the 94 version are a mess.
Yeah, I was just...
I think once it gets on the cruise ship and it finds its focus, then it gets better, but... And then there's this weird thing of how she pretends that she's a woman who used to date him that he then forgot about.
Yeah, I don't get that. I'm like, is that funny movie? I don't understand.
I have no idea where that came from. And then, of course, in this version, they sleep together instead of just having a kiss.
Yeah.
Which doesn't entirely bother me much, but...
You know what? I didn't go for it because...
They didn't get explicit about it. We just saw the door close.
I preferred it in the original when they didn't sleep together because it was almost an affair of the heart.
Right. That's true.
As opposed to, like, nope, they're actually cheating on their fiancés now.
And that's what I find interesting is that even in the 90s version, they aren't married.
Yeah.
Like, you'd think in the 90s version, at least, the affair would be on actual spouses as opposed to just people that they're engaged to.
Yeah, and I don't get it.
I'm surprised that they pushed it in one area, but they didn't push it in another.
But I don't get the whole Warren Beatty sexy guy, but then I never got the appeal of Warren Beatty, so I don't think I'm ever going to get that.
Yeah, he works for some people, he doesn't work for others. I think he's a good, charming guy, but he's Warren Beatty. You know, you either like him or you don't.
True.
Cary Grant is impossible to not like.
It's true. I mean, like, you hear his voice and you're like, well, I don't eat my panties anymore. I'm just going to throw them at him.
You know what I liked about the Charles Boyer character is I almost got the sense this dude's a gigolo. I mean, gigolos aren't just male prostitutes. They try to find rich women to shack up with that they can live off of.
Oh, my God. I didn't even think of that.
And that's basically what he's doing. You know, he gave up his painting so he could just find rich women to shack up with. And that's what he did.
I didn't even consider that, but yeah, it's true.
He's essentially a gigolo in that movie. I mean, of course, they kind of smooth over that to the 50s version, just to have it be that, oh, he's a rich socialite himself, but they never say how he got rich.
Yeah.
You know, in the original film, he's not a rich guy. He's just trying to marry into money. And then he ends up falling in love with this woman and kind of gives up that dream and ends up making a life for himself elsewhere. Yeah, he is. He's a gigolo. He's trying to find the easy way out, but he finds more satisfaction in the hard way out, ultimately. That's one of the things I liked about the original.
I didn't even see that, but now that I think of it, wow, how did I miss that?
Yeah, he's a gigolo, man.
You know what with all the characters, they're supposed to be Lotharios. With Michelle, I didn't really get it, but apparently I missed the whole part where he's a gigolo. Whoosh!
Well, no, I mean, if you think about it, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, this... Yeah, I mean, it's weird that, you know, he's very dismissive of these beautiful women who come up to him for his autograph as opposed to, you know, trying to hit on them.
Because they're being fucking rude.
Right. Well, I mean, he's only interested in seducing for money.
Or that, or seducing women that he wants to seduce, not women that come up to him and are like, oh my God, you're so fantastical. Apparently, it's an ego boost for him to seduce someone who might be dismissive of him.
When he meets Terry, it's more he becomes interested with her, not only because when she finds out who he is, she doesn't get all bubbly and say, can I have your autograph? She stands up to him and she puts up an intellectual fight against him, you know? She's someone interesting. She's someone he's kind of intrigued by.
And I think we can both agree that Cary Grant, anyone can be like, oh yeah, he flirts with everything. I believe that.
I love how flippant he is about just tossing out lies to get out of things. Like, hey, will you join me and my wife for bridge? I cheat.
I love that kind of back and forth that seemed to be really popular at that point.
Well, depending on what filmmakers you got, but yeah. The gal who did the TV series Gilmore Girls, she talks about how films from the 30s were very influential on her because they have that snappy rat-a-tat dialogue, that back and forthness, but still also feeling very natural and real.
And if you watch any of the Thin Man movies.
Thin Man's, if you watch any of Howard Hawks' movies, he was fantastic with dialogue too. Yeah, I mean, there were some directors, Leo McCarey and Howard Hawks, actually worked with their actors in improv sessions to smooth out the dialogue and make it feel more natural and real.
I think it was Woody Van Dyke that did the first few Thin Man movies. He apparently would do like one take.
Okay.
So if you didn't get it... Yeah, I don't know what his plan was if he didn't get the shot he wanted.
You know, a lot of films back then, they only needed one or two takes because a lot of these actors were theater trained, and they actually did go through a lot of rehearsal before it.
Yeah, they did. That's true.
The problem with a lot of films nowadays is they don't rehearse as much.
Yeah.
Because they want to do it on the scene.
Yeah, which would help with some people for, you know, like Megan Fox. Sweetie could really use some rehearsals and acting lessons.
I disagree with you.
And talent.
Hey, she was great on Hope and Faith.
Yeah, how long ago was that, Noel?
About a decade. All right, let's get back on track here.
Okay.
Why don't we talk about the grandmothers / aunt?
Okay.
What did you think about the various actresses they had playing his grandmothers, or aunt, as they did in the 90s version?
I think my favorite one was the one in 57, but that's because I just love 57.
I thought all of them were adorable, even Katharine Hepburn in the 90s version, which we should say was her last film.
Really? That was the last one?
Yep, her last film. I mean, she was so palsied by then, but she was so... There's still such a great strength and vibrancy to her character. I thought she was good.
She was. It's just... I think I wanted more Katharine Hepburn, and I really wasn't invested in the characters at that point either.
Yeah, I mean, it does kind of come on the tail of those really rough 20 minutes in the 90s version. But, you know, by then, I think it's when the film starts to get its focus.
Hold on, I've got a note here for the 94 version. I'm not 20 minutes in, and already I want the movie to die. It wants so badly to be witty and have that playful banter, but it's failing.
Yeah.
And then the very next one is this supposed to be witty banter?
I thought the scenes were good with Gary Shandling and Harold Ramis.
Harold Ramis is in this movie. They have, like, really awesome, like, Harold Ramis, how do you waste that?
Right, and then who was the actress who played her co-singer?
Oh my God, Chloe Webb. She was in Sid and Nancy.
Okay.
That's where I know her from, so it's really
weird. Yeah, the 90s version had a great cast, and once you get past those 20 minutes, it's really... And then Glenn Shaddix as the paparazzi photographer.
That's the thing that pissed me off, is the fact that he's this paparazzi photographer, and then he just disappears, and we never see him again.
Well, remember, he tricked him into getting off the ship and going on to a different assignment, remember?
I didn't know...
Right. I mean, I thought they could have included his character in a couple later spots in the movie, but...
Yeah.
It was fun while it lasted. He was probably in the film more than he needed to be, and that's probably why you felt his absence more when he disappeared. You know, in the original film, it's just a random guy who shows up in one scene and takes their photo, and here, they built him up as an entire paparazzi photographer.
Except that he never took a photo of them, so...
Right.
You don't get the payoff of, oh, he's a paparazzo. I'm like, well, not a very good one, apparently.
But hey, it's Glenn Shaddix. The late, great Glenn Shaddix. He was great.
I miss him.
I do too. So back to the grandmothers. I love that all of the grandmothers, I'm just going to say grandmothers even though the one was an aunt.
Why did they change that?
Because Warren Beatty was older, which doesn't make sense because Cary Grant was probably older than he was in his version than Beatty was in his. I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, my grandmother lived till she was quite old. I was probably in my early 20s when my grandmother died.
Well, yeah, but Cary Grant was in his 50s. So would his grandmother still be alive? His grandmother, not his mother, his grandmother. Yeah. And Warren Beatty, I think, was, what, late 40s, early 50s by this point?
Oh, did I say grandmother or did I say great-grandmother?
Well, you said grandmother. Did you mean great-grandmother?
Yeah, I meant great-grandmother. My great-grandmother, like, lived till I was about in my early 20s.
And how old was your mom or your parent?
My mom, I think her mid to late 40s.
Okay, I mean, Cary Grant was, like, getting close to 60 by this point, you know?
And my great-grandmother lived quite a long time, and this was refusing, like, all kinds of surgeries and vitamins and glasses and hearing aids.
Okay.
So I'm just like, no, old people can hold out that long.
Well, let me check.
Especially if they're European stock.
Yeah, let me check here. Cary Grant was 53 when he did that, and Warren Beatty was, let me see.
Riddled with venereal disease because he had slept with so many women?
He was 57. Oh, so Warren Beatty was older than Cary Grant in his version.
Oh.
Wow, Warren Beatty was almost 60 in his. Okay.
Well, that certainly explains why I didn't want to watch the movie.
Yeah, okay, so, well, I mean, I can understand why they did it with the grammar, but I don't entirely understand why they didn't do that in the 50s version, but okay. Mm-hmm. I like that the grandmother, the scene is, it's this very wonderful, beautiful sequence of meeting the grandmother character, and yet you know this is probably going to be the last time he'll ever see her. Even she knows it, you know? And he doesn't want to believe it.
Yeah, especially, I think, well, at least I got it in the original... And the 57 version.
Oh, yeah, the original, especially when she starts crying.
Yeah.
When you hear the boat whistle.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like boat whistles.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely the farewell. And even you have that great scene where he comes up, where he's hoping to see her, and yet he's not entirely surprised to find out that, no, she's dead and the house is empty now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a surprising thing, is you would think that instead of now being kind of poor and having to scrape life for himself, he would have inherited that estate.
You would think so.
Maybe, in fact, in the 30s and 50s version, that's why he's ultimately planning to move back to Europe.
Yeah.
Because he's just going to take over that estate
then. That could be it, yeah. You know what? I never really questioned it because I was just more interested in the characters as to, oh no, what's financially going to happen with the estate? I didn't really care.
Right. Well, I mean, why the finances of the characters is such a big part of the story. That's kind of why I picked up on it.
Noel's like, what's going to happen with her estate? That's really about Noel.
No, it's just that they're making such a big thing about, oh, now they're poor and having to scrape along a living. But it's like, but wait, wouldn't he have inherited that from the grandmother? Especially in the 50s, where it's full of all these priceless artifacts. And it's like, oh, my husband liked to collect beautiful things. Man, imagine how much all that is worth, you know? I mean, I'm not trying to be insensitive to her. I mean, most of that he's probably going to keep. But, you know, it's if he needed to make a living, that's a place he could live.
Yeah. You know?
And then in the 90s version, where she has like this huge patch of land beneath the Hawaiian volcanoes and has horses running through fields. And I mean, that place
and
is huge.
And all kinds of animals, yeah.
That place is freaking huge.
Well, maybe she didn't leave it to him.
I left it to Manuela, the pool boy. He made me happy in my last days. He cleaned my pipes.
Oh, okay. Thank you for making me think of Katharine Hepburn's pipes, Noel. Thank you so much.
Well, at least I didn't come up with the image of Katharine Hepburn getting her pussy shaved.
Ah, la, la. Retcon. I retconned it. Stop it, Noel. I'm not Dana.
I love you, too.
Thank God for that, because otherwise I'd have to punch you through the computer screen. Don't know how I'd manage that, but I would.
Yeah, so anyways, anything else you want to add about the grandmothers?
In the 94 version, when mm-hmm. she and Terry are talking about the monogamy of farm animals, I wanted to die.
Yeah, it's my nephew is a duck.
Yeah. No, he's a swan. And until he meets another swan, he'll think he's a duck. And I'm like, please. Lord.
Yes.
My note is literally all this talk of ducks and swans is fascinating. Please, Lord, take me now. I was just like, dear God.
I want to rename the movie, He Thinks He's a Duck.
But he's a swan.
At least they didn't start watching Howard the Duck.
That's the only way that...
Yeah, it's an odd conversation that just comes out of nowhere. He's a swan, but he thinks he's a duck.
Yeah. That whole about the monogamy of farm animals, I'm like, I don't care. What the hell?
Right. They're hitting their metaphor way too hard with a sledgehammer there.
Yeah, I was like, Jesus, people, I get it. It's the pink champagne in the first movie where there's pink champagne. And I was just like, do you want to beat that metaphor into the ground some more, or are we done? Oh, no, we're going to beat it into the ground some more. Great.
Oh, yeah. He wants to go down and drink your pink champagne.
Ew. That ain't pink champagne down there.
It tickles his nose while he does it.
Ah, gross.
Well, at least he's not doing it to Katharine Hepburn.
Thank you. Thank you, Noel. Just thank you.
And that brings us full circle. Okay, well, hey, let's talk about the kids.
Ugh. Do we have to?
Her school choir of children and all. Yeah, the original one, I like that, you know, it's an orphanage run by a guy named Pussface, who actually does have a very sour puss face, but yeah.
It's not Pussface. They were calling him Sour Puss.
No, I thought it was Puss Face. Okay.
No, it would have been like a Sour Puss or something like that.
Sour Puss? I don't know, but it had a puss.
Puss is actually a face. Like, Puss would have been slang for face.
Speaking of pink champagne.
Ah, buzzing.
Yeah, I didn't mind the kids too much in the old one because, you know, they knew when to have and when not to. I actually liked the bits where it turns out that they've all been hiding behind the fence and listening and all that whatnot.
You know what? I give the movie that much because it's so obvious that that's what's happening, but at the same time, it's just like, oh, it's cute.
And unfortunately, it's like they sing the same freaking song three times, though.
Oh, God.
Wishing, la-da-da-da-da. You know, it's shut up.
That was the other thing, that same song. And I was just like, wow, I like your metaphors.
Right, yeah.
Show them to me again because I love the repetition.
Right. And then, you know, in the 50s version, they tried to actually expand the kids' roles a bit, actually making a few of them into personalities and whatnot. And I love when they're doing the musical number, we have to get the black kids to do a tap dance solo.
Of course. You know what? At least they had black kids.
Yeah, I was surprised by how well, even the 1930s one had a couple black kids.
But in the 57 one, one of the black kids actually gets a line.
True.
I can't remember the kid's name for the love of God in me, but he gets a line. He delivered it really well, too.
He did. Yes. And of course, both of them have the girl who can't sing. So it's like, just pretend and mouth along with the words.
Well, no, in the original, it was a girl who she had lost her voice.
Well, she caught laryngitis, I know. But yeah, but it's still the same bit.
Well, I don't know. In the 57 version, it was just that she was singing too loud. It's not that she couldn't sing.
I thought there was a girl who was too quiet, too.
Yeah, no, there wasn't a girl that sang too. It was just the one that sings too loud. And then
okay.
She and one of the other girls, or a couple of the other girls, have like a little bit solo or like a little duet or a triet or whatever the hell you call them thing. And she sings just fine. Okay, this is so random, but it amused me. The kid in the 57 version wearing the flying ace cap with the goggles. I love that. I'm like, why is that even a winter hat? But okay. It's so random, but it's awesome.
Wow. Yeah, I actually really like the kid from the beginning of the film on the boat who's climbing the stairs, and it's that whole bit of, you know, you should be careful. I broke my leg when I was your age. And he says, well, how is it now? It's fine. Well, what are you crabbing about then?
Okay, the kid.
In the 30s one, I thought he was really good. In the 50s one, that
not as
like
good,
so
yeah.
Well. Yeah. The kid in the 30s is great.
The kid from the 30s, I don't know where I've known him from, but I've seen him in other movies. I love that kid.
And I love how Michelle is like doing the lap clap thing with him. And the kid had the lines of, oh, you're the person my parents keep talking about. Well, what are they saying? I don't know. They keep sending me out of the room. And he's almost like pulling back to punch the kid, but he doesn't.
Yeah.
That kid was awesome.
That kid, oh, God, he was really good.
Yeah, here, let me look him up real quick. His name is Scotty Beckett.
He was in My Favorite Wife with Irene Dunne and Cary Grant.
Okay, well, there you go.
That's where I know him from.
Okay.
He was really good in that, too.
Awesome.
Scotty Beckett, you're awesome. I love you. Please don't be dead.
And he's dead. 1968.
Son of a bitch.
Oh, wow, he wasn't even 40.
Dear Lord, Channing Tatum, come on.
Oh, he died of an overdose of barbiturates.
Channing Tatum, I'm still willing to trade, Lord.
Okay, so we're getting distracted by the kids, Greg.
Yeah, because that kid was good.
And then you get to the 90s version, and the kids are just kind of background for just her, basically, teaching the class.
Well, yeah, it's more...
They aren't really developed as characters anymore. They're just, that's her job now.
Yeah, because, well, I think it's Chloe Webb's class, and she's just sort of... I don't know if she's helping out or teaching the kids music or whatever, but she's not really in it.
Right. It's just this is how she's making a living now.
Yeah.
And then I love how you have that great bit of her having to push her wheelchair up a hill and then having to stop and just take her breath before she starts pushing it again. That was like the only moment in the entire, all three of them that you realize, okay, now she's in a wheelchair and it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my sister is in a wheelchair. It's not easy.
Yeah.
I don't even think, do you... Oh, yeah, you do get to see her in a wheelchair and the other ones when she's teaching. So, yeah, never mind.
Yeah, but you don't really get to see her moving around in the wheelchair at all. So it,
right.
She makes it seem almost like it's the easiest thing.
Right. It's like she's in the chair or she's sitting. You never really see the hardness of how it is to transition from one to another. You don't entirely get that in the 90s version either. They all kind of gloss over it. The 90s version at least had that moment of her on a hill having to go uphill.
Yeah. At least had that much, because, yeah, with the other ones, it was just, it really did gloss over that.
Well, how about the music? Let me talk about the music for all of them. You know, the music in the original one didn't really stand out much. I mean, it did have the central love theme that actually did carry through the other movies, but I didn't think the songs really stood out particularly much. And then you get to the 50s one where you have the main song, An Affair to Remember.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
Sung by Vic Damone.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then isn't it sung by...
I think she does sing it at one point, too.
Well, she doesn't herself. It was whoever was dubbing her voice, but...
Yeah. Okay, the music in the 94 version.
I didn't have as much of a problem with it as you did.
Really?
I actually compare the 90s version, stylistically and even with music, to the 90s version of Parent Trap.
Get off my lawn, Noel.
I thought, you know, its use of licensed song as well as a kind of piano-heavy score, I thought it was really... I liked it.
Noel, get off my lawn right now. I'm not even kidding. You, off my lawn, now.
Okay, what did you hate about the music?
It doesn't fit the film. Like, there's just this... It starts off with the saxophone and, like, this...
It is a little playful.
But...
And a little more playful than it probably should be for the drama, but...
Yeah, and there's just so much of it. And the saxophone is a really overwhelming kind of instrument, which is great if you're doing, like, a noir movie, because you can kind of do that. But this is Love Affair. Just...
Yeah.
I have, in all caps, oh, fuck off music at one point.
I liked it. Of course I did.
Yeah, of course you did.
I thought it worked fine in the earlier parts of the film where it was supposed to be playful. It gave me something to enjoy during those opening 20 minutes that it was a mess. I didn't mind it so much as it went along, because I noticed that as it went along, it became less saxophone and more piano.
Yeah, but you know what? I did realize that, but I think... At that point, it had really lost me in the beginning where there was so much, like, I don't understand why they felt the need to have all that, like, really loud-ish, playful, whatever, music in the beginning.
Let's just agree that the beginning of this film is a mess pretty much all around.
Oh, God, yes. Hard copy, though. I got to see hard copy. I used to watch that show when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Holla.
I mean, yeah, the only parts that are really good in the opening 20 minutes is, like, the first couple when it's just intercutting with Gary Shandling talking to him and...
Yeah. Oh, God, you remember when Terry drops the purse in the 94 version?
Mm-hmm.
You get to see Annette Bening's bikini bottom. Yeah, everyone wanted to see that, apparently. So there you go.
Okay.
And...
Well, we've seen a lot more of her in other movies.
Yeah,
so.
But... Still.
I wasn't watching for it, so no. Okay.
And okay, those birth control pills, they must be glued in. Because I'm like, why didn't they fall out? What's up? No? I guess they're glued in. Okay.
Is that something that commonly pops open?
It really shouldn't.
Okay.
Because if it does, that's kind of a problem.
Then why would the pills go all over the place?
No, I mean, the case itself shouldn't open, and the case did.
Oh, okay. I see what you mean.
Yeah. I'm like, you don't get that it's like, you know, the case is open, and that's how I could see that it was just birth control, not like a mouth guard or something. I don't know. They have weird cases for mouth guards now.
Yes, because she needs her random airplane mouth guard.
Well, if she falls asleep on the plane and she grinds her teeth.
Well, it's also to keep him from randomly Frenching her in her sleep, so.
Yeah.
Let's see. But, you know, as I mentioned, if I can just kind of change tactics here, I actually thought this remake was very comparable in style to the Parent Trap remake. In that, in the way that it balances staying true to the original while also kind of trying to update it and kind of make it its own thing. It didn't really change the story. It kind of just changed how it told specific elements within the story. I mean, I'm not saying it's as good as the Parent Trap remake.
Damn well better not be.
I just noticed a similarity in terms of how much they stuck with the original and how much they did things different. I just noticed a similar balance.
You know what? I will agree with you that they are doing their own thing. It is similar, but if you smash everything forever, is that a good enough reason? No. There's so much of it where it's what a completely random happenstance that this occurs. And I'm just like, you know what? They could just be on
in the original film. It was random too. They just did a better job of executing it.
Well,
so
yeah,
because
they're just on a cruise, which makes sense. Whereas they're on a plane that has to land.
Oh yeah. No, the first 20 minutes are a complete mess. I've never disagreed with you on that.
So we're just going to retcon the first 20 minutes.
If you can get through the first 20 minutes, I thought it was a good film after that. That's just me. I thought it recovered after it fumbled.
You know what the thing is, too? With the first two movies, they're together for like 8 days, approximately.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with the 94 version, it's 3 days.
Well, and I don't know if you noticed it, but it's also we'll meet in 3 months instead of 6 months.
Yeah, I noticed that, too. And I'm just like, you guys, maybe give yourself a bit more time. No? Okay.
I agree with you on that. It's like they're trying to say, well, in the modern day, relationships go faster. Not all the time.
Yeah, no, I mean, if they're going to do it in 3 months, I'm like, you know what, why don't you just go for it now? Because 3 months, it's not a big difference in time.
Right. I know. I agree with you there. I don't understand why they decided to play with the timeline.
I would have at least given them 3 months had they spent more than 3 days together.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm like, 3 days? It's like, no. At that point, if he says 3 months, I would have been like, no, let's do 6 instead, because I've only spent 3 days with you and I need to actually figure out whether I want to break up with my fiance for some guy that I've known for 3 days who's apparently a huge player.
Exactly. And a player who, it's theorized, only has his job because of his rich fiance.
Exactly. I'm like, no, okay. You're clearly making good choices, guys.
Yeah. And what I like in the 50s and the 90s version is he flat out admits he cheats on everyone.
Yeah, but when Cary Grant does it, he's just so fucking charming.
Right. I don't entirely get why they changed his name in the 50s version to Nicky instead of Michelle.
Because Nicky.
And this is at least the second time I've seen him play a Frenchman with a British accent. The other one was I Was a Male War Bride, where he actually was French and had absolutely no French accent. He had as much of a French accent as Sean Connery had a Russian accent in A Hunt for Red October.
Well, if you want to go there, then I can also bring up the fact that Ever After was set in France and yet everyone had English accents.
Well, but technically you could get by the fact that, you know, they're speaking in French, but we're only hearing it in English.
With English accents? No, it doesn't. And it happens in Troy when everyone who's Greek.
I can get past it in those because,
Richard,
you know,
you're in the Jackal. Yeah.
Okay.
There we go.
I can get past it in historical films because, you know, they're not speaking the language that they're supposed to be speaking. And everyone trying to mumble in an accent would kind of get a little weird. But when it's more modern films and someone is supposed to be from a country and they're supposed to be talking with an accent, it makes sense for me in the 50s version because you get a sense that he's a little more worldly and he's probably kind of shed the accent over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, when he does speak French, he speaks it quite well and beautifully.
True fact. Okay, in the 94 version, why can't she tell him that she got hit by a car and is in a wheelchair? Why? I would have almost preferred if they had swapped out the genders and made him the one who got hit by a car, because I understand the whole male thing with, well, I don't want to be a burden to her, and I am a man, and I must be manly and my masculine.
I don't know if my penis works or not.
I think he would know shortly.
Or longly, as is the case.
Bazinga. Okay, and the doctor in the 94 version, am I the only one who thinks that he's the worst doctor ever?
Why?
With, like, he is the worst bedside manner.
Well, I've been in a lot of hospitals, so it's not uncommon. They get tired of having to deal with so many patients. It's not so much that it's anything personal, it's just they get exhausted, even emotionally.
At the same time, too, I'm like, she might never walk again. Maybe just fucking give her some hope, or at least act vaguely interested. It's not like she has a fucking cold. I'm swearing a lot.
I know.
I swear too much. It's not ladylike.
I know. I agree with you.
Oh, the kiss in the 1957 version.
Yeah, well, why don't we cover all of them here, the first kiss. You know, I like the first one, how, you know, they try to keep everything hidden, and then they do it behind an open door. You know, it's just that interesting metaphor of they've opened the door, but they're hiding behind the open door as they have their first kiss. And then you mentioned something about the standards and practices.
Yeah, well, in the 57 version.
Well, this would have been in the 30s version, because this was 39, so this was after the film code had gone into application.
See, the thing is, I can't ever seem to get a handle on the code and when it was being enforced and when it wasn't and when it was allowed. The thing is, it wasn't the first time that they had put out a movie like that, so I really have trouble finding out when the code was enforced and what they would allow and what they wouldn't, because it's really a muddled mess, and you can't really tell. But they did have the decency code, and there was a kind of, which is why you have a lot of actors in old movies, and they kind of press their cheeks together.
Right. You never see their actual lips touch. It's kind of like their heads are turned.
Yeah, either that or they do the Spike and Drusilla thing where their cheeks are sort of pressed together as they're looking in the same direction. They were only allowed to kiss for a certain amount of time. And so the face press, it gave them that intimacy without it. So here they kind of, I guess, got around it.
Right. In the 1930s, yeah, they have the kiss happen initially off screen, and then the camera picks up and just catches the last few seconds of the kiss as they pull apart.
Whereas in the 57 one, you don't really see it.
They step up the stairs right out of frame and it happens. Yeah, exactly.
But holy hell, is that a romantic kiss that we never see.
And then, of course, in the 90s version, they sleep together.
Oh, of course, because that's how you say I love you, by getting naked.
Well, in the 1930s, they follow the 1930s with the kiss happening behind the open door, which actually makes a little more of a metaphor because you still have the paparazzi dude running around, and then you just see the door close.
Oh, no, the paparazzi dude was gone by that point.
He was somewhere, but it was still you still have the metaphor. This is something they're trying to keep hidden, and they do it behind an open door. I just love the thought behind that.
Seriously, was this a major release, or was it like a Lifetime movie or what?
You mean the 90s version?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Seriously?
It was a wide release. It just didn't do well.
Yeah, no kidding.
And I'm wondering if there's like some copyright issues, because it was only released briefly. I know you said in Canada it's available on DVD, but here in the US it was only released on DVD briefly before going out of print again. And used copies of the DVD are actually running for like $50-$60.
You know what? No, well, I will send you my copy. You can have
that. I'm fine. I picked up the video.
Shut up, Noel. You're getting my copy.
I don't want it. I got my video.
Too bad. It's too bad. It's got special features on it. You like special features. You're taking it.
Oh, what features does it have?
I don't know. Just take it. I don't want it.
Okay, fine. If you want to get rid of it, I'll take it.
I like that I turned into a shrieking woman at one point.
Yeah, but the video I thought was okay because they did open mat instead of pan and scan, so it's still playing fine. Yeah, so if anyone wanted to check out this movie, all you can do is watch the video. If you live in the U.S.
Or you can order it from Amazon.ca.
Yeah, or you can order it from Canada.
Oh my God, Deborah Carr's dresses.
Go ahead, tell me about Deborah Carr's dresses.
I love them all. I want to marry them and have tiny little cloth babies with them.
I thought the first one looked a little too much like, you know, when she had the red jacket, and then after she takes out the red jacket, it looked a little too much like Scarlett O'Hara made something out of curtains.
I like that. It felt really, you know what?
A little too interwoven drapes for me.
Well, that's because you're not a girl.
I know.
I love that dress. My favorite one, though, is the one where she goes to meet the grandmother.
Yep.
That is just gorgeous. Everything she wears, which, by the way, she's supposed to be, like, poor and on a budget at one point, and she still looks so put together.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of my issue, is that even when she's poor, the 50s version is still glamorous. I mean, that apartment is beautiful.
Though she does have the guy friend, the ex-fiancé, who, though, yes, he won't be paying for treatment, that doesn't mean he's not giving her clothes and stuff like that and furnishing the apartment.
But what I liked about the 30s and the 90s version is she does become a little more... I mean, in the 30s version especially, she loses the furs, her clothing gets a little more plain, a little
that.
More, and her apartment is a little more reserved and plain. You just have the little parlor and then the bedroom.
Yeah.
And then especially in the 90s version, her apartment is kind of bare, and it just looks like she only just moved in and still has things stacked against the walls and it still hasn't finished sorting everything yet.
Yeah, because she's got the pictures against the walls and everything that haven't been hung yet.
Yeah, so you get the sense that she's still getting it moved in. And plus, you know, it takes a while to do that when you're in a wheelchair, so.
Apparently she doesn't have any friends who will hang pictures for her. Dicks. Oh, and this is such a little random thing that I love so much more in the 57 version than I did in the 39 original. Is when Deborah Carr, that scene where Terry's going the wrong way and she comes back.
Mm-hmm.
That she's going, you know, oh, I'm going the wrong way, that I got all turned around and the Empire State Building is actually that way.
Yeah.
In the 39 version, it happens so quickly. It's not really played as well as, okay, in the 57 version, for a second, he thinks she's coming back to him.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay.
And I love that. Whereas, you know, in the 39 version, it's just a scene that's happening.
I know you see the smile pop on his face, but I agree. It does go by a little quicker.
Yeah, I like the 57 version because for a second there, he thinks she's coming back. And then she's just like, I totally got turned around. The Empire State Building's that way. Bye.
And that's the other thing I like is in the 30s and the 50s version, you have the cab driver.
Mm-hmm.
They have like this really sweet moment where she's like, I'm getting married and I want you to be the first to know. And he's like, just this really sweet thing. And then she gets hit and he's like, oh my God. And then in the 90s version, it's like the most annoying New York cab driver who won't shut the fuck up you can imagine.
I know.
And she somehow says, I still want you to be the first to know.
Yeah, I'm like, like, why?
Right. It's like, get out and just run. Yeah. I mean, you can understand why she got out of the cab just to get away from this guy.
Yeah, she's like, oh no, it's traffic that's stopping. Which, by the way, why does she only leave like half an hour to get there?
Right. I mean, and you know he's going to be waiting for her, so why is she in such a rush? So
I'm sorry, but okay, if it was Cary Grant, I'd be there at like 10 the evening before and be like, no, I'm waiting for Cary Grant.
Yes.
Waiting for Cary Grant! Shut up! I don't care that the observation deck is closed, I will sleep here.
What are your final thoughts on the three movies?
Well, for the 39 version, it seems to kind of go out on a laugh with the, if you can paint, I can walk.
It goes on a much more hopeful note, yeah.
You know what? I don't even see it as hopeful. I see it as kind of a laugh line. And I was just like,
Really?
I think the way that they just played it as, you know, like, oh, if you can paint, which it's a miracle that you can, then I can walk, which would also be a miracle. Isn't that funny?
Yeah. Well, I never liked the line to begin with, but
yeah,
even in the 50s version.
Though I think Deborah Carr does infuse it with a certain amount of emotion that is sort of lacking from the other two.
Yeah. And you still don't like the 90s version?
I like parts. I like Katharine Hepburn. Except when she talks about mating animals.
Yeah.
Ew. Yeah, the 57 version. I love it. Love it so much. I want to have its tiny movie babies.
So if you had to pick one of these films to watch once a year, every year, and you could only pick one.
57. This is the movie that I do at least watch once a year. So I don't have to pick one. This is the one that I watch once a year.
No, I
agree. I have hobbies.
I agree with you that the 90s version is the weakest of them. I still think it's a decent movie. If someone were to catch it on TV or something, it would be a decent watch. But yeah, it's still kind of a mess. And I have a hard time picking between the other two. I'm probably ultimately going to go with the 57 version just because Grant and Carr are so great.
Yeah.
But man, I love the 30s version too. I don't know. There was something about it that just, it felt more grounded and more everyday. You know, it felt more real.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not knocking the 57 version, but the 57 version is, it's glamour. It's Hollywood. It's beautiful. There's something a little rougher and a little grittier and a little less opulent about the 30s version that I kind of liked.
You know what? You're right, because there is a certain aspect of the 57 version where it's much more streamlined and it's much more clever.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, I mean, I might just be seeing it as fault in the 39 version, but it is still a bit more realistic where, like, the banter, it feels much more clever in the 57 version, but it does feel much
even
more...
though it's, most of it is the same banter.
Yeah. The thing is, in the 57 version, it's much more crisp and clever, but in the 39 version, it does feel more real.
It feels a little more uncertain and a little more hesitant, and that actually kind of feels more honest to me.
Yeah, the delivery definitely feels much more real as opposed to with the 57 version, where though it's still, like, it's an amazing delivery, and watching Deborah Carr and Cary Grant go back and forth, I mean, it's seriously like watching two tennis pros work.
Yeah.
But it's a little too crisp, if you want to go that way.
It's a little too practiced and a little too polished. You know, I think ultimately if I had to pick between the two, I would pick the 30s version,
mm-hmm.
though I'm saying that just slimly, I'm in favor of that one more. I think that both of them are fantastic movies.
Yeah. You know what? I think I might give the 39 version another try, but the 94?
Yeah, I don't blame you if you never see it again.
Well, here, let me give you my last two notes that I wrote on it.
Okay.
Is this movie over yet? Please end now, please. And my very last one is, seriously, this is like watching my parents after a fight. Just make this thing end. Seriously, like, there's a point where I'm like, this is pretty much what my parents would act like after they had had, like, some all-out fight. So
it was a little too close to home.
Yeah, and I think the fact they kind of look like my parents, too. Yeah, there's one where I figured it out. The two leads look like my parents. I just threw up in my mouth.
I think the 90s version is a good enough of a movie. It's just, it's nothing more than just good enough.
If it were a movie, I would give it a C.
If it were its own movie, yeah, it would probably be a decent watchable movie. But in comparison to the other two, it just doesn't hold up.
Yeah, it's just like, you tried, but you didn't try very hard, did you, movie?
Right. So I think that brings us to the end.
I love you, Cary Grant!
We didn't record for 6 hours.
Woo! Holla!
All right.
I need to stop saying holler because I'm not Kesha. And you know what? You can't brush your teeth with a bottle of Jack because that's just wasteful.
Right. Ew. All right. Well, do you want to tell people what we're doing next month?
It's the greatest movie ever. What up, Harry Hamlin? How you doing? I love you. We're going to be doing Clash of the Titans. And one is starring Harry Hamlin and the other one is starring Manly Oatmeal Guy. I don't care what his name is.
Yeah, so we're going to be doing Clash of the Titans, and we're going to have a special guest.
Santa?
We're going to have our special guest, Dana, who's been doing the illustrations for our page. This isn't Dana from Made of Fail. This is your friend, Dana.
Yes, there's no Y in her name. That's why you know she's different.
She's Dana without the Y! So that's going to be a fun episode, and very much looking forward to that.
Yeah, she's quite researched in the myths and stuff like that, so I'm looking forward to a lot of Dana mythology smash.
Okay.
And, you know, just really terrified screaming and, oh, why?
So we'll make up for the lack of a Y in her name.
Exactly.
Okay, well, I'm very much looking forward to this because I've seen the original Clash of the Titans, but I haven't seen the remake yet, so I'm looking forward to this.
You know what? I haven't seen the remake either. I've seen the trailer. Unleash the Kraken.
Yes.
Okay.
I believe it's Release the Kraken.
Whatever. I like Unleash better, but...
It's Liam Neeson. It works.
Yeah.
Just because it's Liam Neeson.
That's not an excuse, okay? Just because it's Liam Neeson, it works. No, it doesn't. It's just not suck.
Hey, Phantom Menace is worth watching just for Liam Neeson. And Ewan McGregor.
It's really not. Not even for Liam Neeson. And I say that as someone who really enjoys Liam Neeson's work.
Hey, he's the only one who could sell the speech about midichlorians.
Yeah. I don't... That didn't happen, Noel. I retconned that. I'm sorry.
Well, why don't we wrap it up here for the night? All right. This brings us to the close of episode 4. Good night, Evie.
Good night, Noel. I'm going to go get drunk on pink champagne.
All right.
If you enjoyed this episode, please check us out at www.ihateloveremakes.com. We've left the comments sections open, so please let us know what you think about the films we've discussed. Speaking of which, I Hate / Love Remakes is in no way affiliated with the copyright holders of the films discussed. All rights are reserved and no infringement is intended. I Hate / Love Remakes is a Made of Fail production.
Wonder if this is still recording. Oh, it probably is.